What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
Greetings, colleagues, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. My name is Dr. Daryl Glover, and along with me is my lovely co-host, Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, and today we have a very exciting show in store for you. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Vision Expo.
Where are the best new ideas and innovations in eye care dreamed up? Industry conferences are the best place to meet and be inspired by optometrists, opticians, and eyewear enthusiasts around the world. That's how Daryl Glover and I teamed up to start Defocus Media.
And guess what, Jen? My favorite conference is right around the corner, the Vision Expo West in Las Vegas. It's the place you want to be if you want to learn, network, build relationships in the world of eye care. This year, there are over 320 hours of continuing education, including 20 specialty tracks and courses in the latest and greatest in innovations in our industry.
You know what I love about Vision Expo?
What's that, Jen?
It's that you can just be walking around exploring and you'll come up on a live interview with a famous eyewear designer or a fashion show parading down the middle of the floor or a live pop-up talk with some of the most recognizable faces in eye care.
Absolutely, Jen. And this year, you can even go job hunting at the Vision Expo West. Covalent Careers will have a live booth to help aid one-on-one networking with employers during the conference. How cool is that? Also, Jen, it gets even better. Young ODs like us have access to exclusive events all during the show, kicked off with the Young Professionals Happy Hour hosted by our buddies at Transitions at Lavo on the Strip. The Happy Hour takes place Friday, September 15th from 4:30 to 6 p.m. I hope to see you guys there.
Make sure you join the Young Professionals Club for free benefits, which includes a free exhibit hall registration and 6 hours of free CE. You just head to visionexpo.com/YPC for all the details.
And trust me, you don't want to miss the CE because it's incredible. And you definitely don't want to miss the exhibit hall. There are over 173,000 square feet of exhibit space housing over 5,000 eyewear brands from all across the world. You'll be the first to see all the fall debut lines, accessories, eyewear trends, and more. The Vision Expo is truly where fashion, education, and innovation all come together under one roof.
Be there September 13th through the 16th at the Sands Expo in sunny Las Vegas, Nevada. Just visit visionexpowest.com to register today.
On to today's podcast.
Hey everybody, this is the Defocus Media Podcast, and you're here with Jennifer Lyerly and my good friend Daryl Glover. How are you today, Daryl?
Life is great, Jen. It's a beautiful day, and I'm just enjoying life.
Well, I love your choice of words there, because beauty is exactly what we're talking about today. And we hear all these words, beauty is pain, beauty in the eye of the beholder. There's so many different eye puns you can go around with this, but this is a topic in optometry that's really taking off, and there are a lot of optometrists looking at specializing in ocular aesthetic. Cosmetic products can have a lot of pros and cons. There can be dangers with the ocular surface, and we need to have that information and a person to help give us a guide on what to talk to our patients about. But of course, all our patients do still want to use beauty product and do so safely. So we brought in an expert in the industry. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jenny Redfern.
I'm here.
Dr. Redfern, tell us about yourself and your background in optometry.
Oh, I'd be happy to. So I'm actually a practicing optometrist in St. Louis, Missouri. I've been in practice for 7 years now. And in my first 5 years in practice, I was actually in a pretty specialty practice, an OD-MD practice, and I have two wonderful, beautiful little girls now. And so I am in a more of a smaller corporate, local corporate setting now in St. Louis. It was a better fit for my family with the schedule and such. And I will say that almost comical to me that I now am speaking about ocular aesthetics, because let me tell you where I came from. So when I first started optometry, thankfully, I've always had pretty decent skin, and I had never really taken care of my skin. It wasn't really something that was emphasized growing up with me. And I worked in this specialty practice where I had a lot of patients coming in asking me about, what can I do about these wrinkles under my eyes? And I was clueless because I didn't wear makeup and I didn't wash my face. This is so funny to me now, but my skincare regimen, if you want to call it that, used to be that when I was in the shower, I would wash my hair, and with whatever shampoo was on my hands, I'd wash my face with it. And that was all I did. And so, you know, people were asking me these questions about, how do I take care of my skin and what about my lashes? And honestly, I had no clue. But enough people kept asking that I realized I needed to learn, because my patients, after I made sure that their eyes were healthy and their vision was clear, they wanted me to help them with other things. And I found it to be extremely rewarding to become educated about these ocular aesthetics, because these can make really big impacts on people's lives.
Well, Dr. Redfern, as Jennifer had mentioned, I am super excited today because I love to top makeup, simply because I'm a man, I don't wear makeup, and I have no clue when it comes to that type of dialogue in the exam room. But I have been learning over the last year due to some of the amazing guests that we've had about ocular aesthetics. So what are the main questions that you receive in the exam room? What products are you recommending? Let's dive a little deeper into the world of ocular aesthetics.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that there are two things that I get asked about the most. One is, and this just happened the other day, what can I do to get rid of these lines and puffiness and dark circles under my eyes? And so, you know, a lot of us already know this, but the under eye skin is some of the thinnest skin in the body. And so it tends to show aging fastest. And I've noticed people, you know, as young as late 20s, early 30s, really starting to have some signs of aging, even if the rest of their face and complexion is perfectly resilient, the under eye area tends to age soonest. And so people ask me a lot about what do I do about this skin under my eyes. And so I do really recommend a good eye cream for everyone 20 and up. I think it's great to just start taking care of that skin. I think it's very important that we educate our patients how to put this eye cream on properly. A lot of people, because the area directly under, you know, the lids and you know, even the upper lids is where they see a lot of this start signs of aging, they tend to put their eye cream way too close to their eyes. So one thing I try to do is to educate my patients on putting their eye creams around the orbital rim. And they tend to just say, well, that's not where the problem is. But when you put eye cream, you know, I tell them almost, okay, feel your cheekbone. And then right above your cheekbone, you know, you can feel where your orbital rim starts. And I don't want you to put that eye cream any closer to your eye than the top of that cheekbone, that orbital rim there, because overnight, that eye cream will seep up toward your eye. If you put it really close to your eye to begin with, it's going to get in your eye. So even the best, quote unquote, safest products for use around the eye, none of these products are meant to go in the eye. So that's one thing too, is just how to use that eye cream properly and to apply it a very small amount with the ring finger, because the ring finger is our weakest finger. And so we don't want to rub and tug at the skin around the eye either. We just want to pat it gently and stay clear of the eye itself.
I really love that advice. The under eye area, I feel like what causes most problems is that it's not hydrated. So talking to them about moisturizers or hydration, but really cleaners that aren't going to dry the skin out in that area tend to make a really big difference. So using like anti-inflammatory products for your eyelid cleansing.
Here's one thing that we'll probably touch on a little bit more in this podcast, but there are wonderful products out there of all kinds. So one thing you're not going to really hear me recommend is any certain brand, because there are brands of things that are specifically made for eyes that still irritate some people. And I think the biggest thing is, especially with eye makeup removers, gosh, some people can just use water and a cloth. Some people need a little bit more and they use products with tea tree oil. And I do think the main thing about, you know, cleansing the eyelid area and moisturizing the eye area is we really need to find what works for our patients. It is just like there is not one dry eye treatment that universally works for everyone. It's the same with ocular aesthetics products. There's not one. There are lots of great eye makeup removers out there. There are lots of great eye creams out there, but it would be silly for me to say that there is one that's best for everyone, because we know with medicine in general, that is not true. Everybody's so different. So yes, there are lots of good things out there for sure.
Have you ever had patients come to you and say, oh, my under eye circles, these glasses are really causing it? And how do you have that conversation about it's not the glasses?
Oh, I know. That's really hard. And sorry not to get off on a tangent, but have you ever had someone wear contacts for the first time and they're like, these contacts are great. I see really well, but now I see my under eye circles. Yes. So I then do go into kind of what causes under eye circles. And, you know, there are a lot of things that can cause under eye circles. And, you know, one is unfortunately just aging can have that effect, that thin skin around the eyes. It thins over time and we start to see darkness. You know, I do have a conversation about vitamin D deficiency with my patients. Now, we all probably have different opinions on this. I do not personally feel comfortable recommending certain dosages of vitamin D for my patients. I've had my blood tested and I know because of my vitamin D blood levels how much I need to take a day. And it's a lot. And it helps me. But it would be, I feel, irresponsible for me to recommend the dosage that I take to all my patients. So I do recommend vitamin D in general to my patients, and I do recommend they go follow up with their primary care doctor to get their blood vitamin D levels checked. We do also, in the conversation of under eye circles, talk about allergies. So allergies can most definitely cause under eye circles. And even if it's not an ocular environmental allergy, you know, there are food sensitivities and food allergies that can cause that too. So, you know, I actually have a functional medicine doctor that I've sent a handful of patients to, and some patients end up having sensitivities to dairy and things, and they eliminate that from their diet and their under eye circles will go away. So it's so, just like everything else, ocular aesthetics is very multifactorial.
One thing that you mentioned there, you're having a good dermatologist referral network. How do you establish that sort of referral pattern to find out what dermatologists in the area are willing to work with optometrists?
Getting a good network referral with other dermatologists, I would say, is no different than getting referrals from any other kind of doctor. So, you know, I've had relationships where we go and meet with OBGYNs because they have patients who are experiencing the pre and post and during menopause and have dry eye issues. I've had, you know, meetings with endocrinologists so that they can refer their diabetic patients to me. And I think when you just get yourself out there, making these relationships with other doctors to let them know that you care about their patients, I think that's really important. So it's no different with dermatology. So I think if dermatologists know that we care about helping our patients with their aesthetics, especially around the eyes, I think that's a very good relationship to have.
Jenny, you know, one thing I never hear whenever I'm talking to the gurus of ocular aesthetics is the use of sunglasses. I mean, with the UV damage, how huge are sunglasses, or wearing a hat or visor? I mean, how much does that actually impact just making the eyes look better, feel better, and not having to rely as much on some of these medications that you have mentioned?
That is so good you bring that. That's huge, actually. Okay, for a lot of reasons. First of all, I mean, the actual UV damage, not only to your eyes, but the skin around your eyes is huge. And, you know, sunglasses don't just cover your eyes, they cover the skin around your eyes too. So just blocking that UV damage to that delicate skin around the eyes is absolutely huge. Because even if we put on sunscreen, we don't put sunscreen all the way up around our eyes. So that's a great way. But here's another thing too that I think people don't think about is when you go out without sunglasses, whether you think about it or not, you're squinting. And when you're squinting, that's where those 11s, those lines in your two brows come in. And just that squinting of your face all day can really cause those wrinkles to increase too. So yes, absolutely. Wearing sunglasses is huge. And I'm one of those people that even on a cloudy day, I find myself needing my sunglasses. Otherwise, I'm squinting. So just not squinting all day is huge too. That's an excellent point.
I kind of view sunglasses as stage one. You know, like we need to start from, that's the first beauty product that you're ever going to use as a person to protect for aging at the eyes. I don't want to say like I scare my young kids, but I mean, maybe a little bit, because I always talk to them. I was like, now let me show you what it's going to look like if you don't wear sunglasses. And I pull up a picture of Pinguecula I have saved on the computer. Especially young girls, they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want my eyes to look like that. And I was like, I know, you have to start wearing your sunglasses now, because it's not reversible if you don't start until you're 40 doing this. So, but yeah, Pinguecula, yellowing of the eye, no kid looks at that and thinks, well, I won't wear my sunglasses.
Jen, I know the best picture that you could show your future patients. You know that picture of that trucker?
Oh, yeah.
With the half of the face just completely damaged due to UV exposure. If you show any child that image, or anyone in general, they're going to completely freak out. And every patient, I guarantee, will wear sunglasses that are nice, big, and protected from here on out.
Absolutely.
That picture freaks me out.
Speaking of products, and I agree with you, I think trying to make a recommendation about, oh, this product's the best one to use, everybody's skin chemistry is different. That's never going to be a reasonable way of approaching anything in healthcare. But mascara, I know you probably get asked about that more than anything else. Do you have any general tips on how to safely and happily make the eye like mascara?
So a couple things about mascara. So I will tell you that I personally think I've tried 30 mascaras in the last few months just experimenting on myself. And again, these things do not apply to everyone. Biggest culprits I've found that irritate the eyes as far as mascara, the number one thing is not taking it off at night. So it just blows my mind how many people don't take their mascara off at night, and it is going to flake into your eye while you sleep. So taking it off, no matter what you use, in my opinion, is the most important thing. I tend to see more problems with people who use mascaras that have the fibers in them. Not everybody. Some people love it and use it well, and I'm not against them, but I have had a lot of people, you know, with those fiber mascaras, those fiber lashes, the fibers can flake off and fall into the eye during the day, especially I have complaints with like contact lens wearers. The other thing, and this is kind of a catch-22 because sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not, but waterproof mascara. So waterproof mascara in general, you know, there's there's a lot more in that mascara to make it waterproof that could potentially be more irritating to the eyes than a non-waterproof. Yet some people find a waterproof to be better because it doesn't get in their eyes. It's just really hard to take off at night. So again, this is one of those things where I think experimenting is the best. Taking it off at night is the number one thing. And then a little off topic of mascara though is eyeliner. The biggest thing about eyeliner is, goodness gracious, it just breaks my heart when I see people come in and putting their mascara on like their waterline, just completely smothering their meibomian glands. That is something I will always recommend against. And it's not necessarily a brand or a type, it's where they apply it.
I want to get Daryl your opinion, because this is something, I mean, I'm with you, Dr. Ripper. I talk about this so many times every single day. I see the fibers in their eye from and hooking onto their contact lenses from that dang fiber mascara, makeup, foundations like smearing all over the front surface of their tear film when they blink, and I'm like, how can you even see? Because you're just looking through cake. Daryl, how do you talk about that as a male doctor? Is it a harder conversation, do you feel like, for you to have?
Jen, I don't necessarily think it's a difficult conversation. I think it's just a conversation that needs to take place. And I'm upfront with my patients. I just tell them, look, you got a lot of debris in your tear film, a lot of makeup, and it looks nasty. And you need to start removing this stuff nightly. Just like you take a shower daily, you got to remove that makeup daily. If not, you're going to set yourself up for a nasty eye infection. You're going to also make it so that your vision's not going to be the sharpest and clearest. It's just going to impact your overall quality of life. How about yourself, Jen?
I think nothing for me does more than the images that we're taking right now in the exam room. So I, for years, was talking about tight lining with eyeliner and how you really shouldn't be doing that. Obviously, you can see it covering and completely obscuring those meibomian glands. So there's no way your tear film's going to be coming out properly as you go through the day. And of course, smearing and wiping that sort of debris and stuff onto your contact lenses or onto your eye surface. But it was like I was talking to a wall. Like I would talk about this stuff and I could see like just looks on my people's faces like, yeah, no, they're going to put their eyeliner on how they're going to. But ever since I had images where I could show them their glands and show them how they're completely covered over by the eyeliner, I've had people say like, oh, you know, there's something about me describing it versus them actually seeing it that seems to make more of a difference.
That's a great point, Jen, because I've taken pictures to show like red eyes, and sometimes when just the makeup is caked and it's just, I don't even want to touch their eye. And I've shown the patient that, and they really, really got the point. It was a take-home message, and they spread the words to their friends as well. Great point.
Dr. Redfern, do you use any imaging in your clinical practice?
Oh, I wish. So I have in the past. I'm not in a situation where I can now, but I could not agree more that that is the most valuable thing. I think imaging in general is huge, whether it's the front of the eye or the back of the eye. Imaging is so key to education. So even though I don't have imaging, I do of people's own eyes, I do have images in the room that I can use to point out what I'm talking about. And so even if you're not in a situation where you have the technology to show them their own eye, I think it's very important to pull out, you know, schematics and examples of other people's eyes. And I think that can be just as effective as well.
Very, very good point.
Dr. Redfern, I have a large following of women, especially women of color. And one thing that I always get asked in the exam room is, what recommendations for my skin around my eyes do you recommend for me? And I never have the right answer. I mean, what do you recommend or what suggestions do you have for women of color?
That is a wonderful question. So I've learned a lot about skin in the last 3 years. And what I've learned, and I'm not going to say that skin tones of different colors aren't different, because they are, but the color of the skin, I feel like, has a lot less of a difference than just the type of skin. So all skin colors can experience dryness. All skin colors can experience irritation. All skin colors can experience inflammation. And so I think it's less important to look at the skin tone than the skin type. So if you have somebody and you can tell their skin is inflamed, we need to look at something that's anti-inflammatory. If we have someone whose skin is dry, we need to look at something that's hydrating. You know, if we have skin, and this doesn't apply necessarily to the eye area, but acne is something that is universal across all skin colors, and the root causes are all the same. So I actually focus much less on skin colors as I do skin types, if that makes sense at all.
So let's talk about some of the skin types. I mean, yeah. What are the three main skin types that you may see in your exam room?
You can really boil things down into inflamed skin. So people that have inflammatory conditions, whether that's sensitivity, perhaps autoimmune conditions that's causing their skin to be inflamed. You have people that have issues with hydration or lack of hydration and dryness. And then we have people, and this maybe this goes into a little bit of the inflammation, but you know, we have skin that is has an excess of oil. And so these are things that really need to be addressed at a root cause. If the skin is inflamed, I think it needs, you know, we need to work on anti-inflammatory things. If the skin is dry, we need to work on hydrating. If the skin is oily, I know this sounds opposite, but one thing that I recently learned, and the best analogy is with dry eye, is that oily skin is actually dehydrated. So I found this fascinating as I started to learn this. So we talk about, people get confused all the time. They're like, my eyes water all the time. We go do our exam and we tell them that they have dry eye. And they're like, no, I don't have dry eye. My eyes are watery. Well, it's the same thing with oily skin. So when the skin gets dehydrated, it will produce excess oil to try to compensate. And so when people have oily skin, if they can find a product that's actually hydrating, not just moisturizing, getting hydration into the skin rather than just putting a moisturizer on top, the oil production will lessen and the skin will balance out. So I think those are the three most common types of skin that I see in general on a daily basis.
I think I fall into the category of oily.
Yeah. And so, you know, with oily skin, you want to find something that's hydrating. And to me, that sounded so opposite until I equated it to dry eye.
It's so fascinating because, like, that's exactly the categories I would say that I think about when I'm actually looking at the lid margin and the glands themselves. So, not a surprise, that is the skin and the glands within the eyelid and the meibomian glands are skin glands. But just another example of how sometimes as eye doctors, I get so focused on just looking at the eye, I miss the fact that, like, oh yeah, the entire skin would tell me this story too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, just like people with facial rosacea, you know, they're meibomian glands. They're going to have telangiectasia along the lid margins. I mean, this is not something that just automatically starts and stops at the lid margin.
So how do you have this conversation with men?
A lot of these conversations, I'll be honest, I don't always initiate these conversations unless people bring them up to me, unless it's causing harm to their health. Rosacea, dryness, those are different things. I have had quite a few men bring up to me, how do I get rid of my under eye circles? So here's a kind of a thing with ocular aesthetics. No, at the end of your exam, if you notice someone has huge puffy under eye circles, am I going to say, you know, I noticed you have some puffy under eye circles there? No, I just don't think that's right to do. You know, we mentioned things that you know, if we notice their glaucoma suspect or we notice their meibomian glands are a mess, we're going to say that because it pertains to their health. We have to be a little careful though when it comes to aesthetics. So even with men, you know, no, I'm not going to necessarily, or women, make comments about their appearance, but I let them bring it up to me. I always end every exam with, you know, your eyes look very healthy. We're going to get you seeing great with your new glasses. Do you have any other concerns about your eyes or the area around your eyes? And I think just opening that up, you'd be surprised at what people will tell you.
This is a sticky kind of subject, and I'm trying to wrap my head around how I best do it. But like you said, waiting for the person to make an issue, it can sometimes offend people. I've done this before where I obviously see the clear signs of ocular rosacea. And then I step back and I say to them, so in addressing the rosacea around your eyelid, and the patients are like, rosacea? I don't have rosacea. And then it becomes this like big issue, right? Where they think a dermatologist should be the one diagnosing them that. They've never heard that they have that before. And then there's this whole different thing going on. So for a while, I was kind of scared off on even talking about and using the word rosacea. And I was saying eyelid inflammation. And then I had this issue where we had a dry eye patient. She was on Restasis. She was on all these different things. And she ended up being really uncomfortable. She sought a second opinion. And the doctor diagnosed her with ocular rosacea. She sent an email back to me. She was like, thank you so much for your help. I finally have my answers. I've had ocular rosacea this whole time. And it was like a smack forehead moment. Like, that's what I've been trying to tell you this whole time, but I didn't use the word. And so you felt like the diagnosis was missed. So now I'm back on the, okay, I'm going to talk to you about rosacea track. Do you ever find yourself with that same issue?
Yes. It's hard because it's hard to come across in a way that you're trying to help them with something and not pointing out something in their appearance, you know, and that brings me to another thing about recommending blepharoplasties. So I find that I have more male patients with pretty severe dermatocolasis than women for whatever reason. And they don't necessarily care about their appearance, but at some point that skin gets in the way of their visual field. And so, you know, if there's ever a way to ask these questions as it relates to function, I think that's very helpful. You know, I had this one conversation, this man, he had pretty severe dermatocolasis to where his eyelids were completely hooded. And I could tell his temporal vision on either side, you know, I imagined was a little bit limited. And I just said, after we're done, I said, you know, I happen to notice, you know, it eyelids, it's really common over time for your upper eyelids to start drooping a little bit. And I said, it's no big deal. If it doesn't bother you, it doesn't bother me, unless you feel like it's impacting your vision, because it can get to the point where it impacts your vision. And he just lit up and he said, you know what? Sometimes at night when I'm driving home, I have to use my hands and I pull up my eyelids so I can see better. And so I think a lot of times, especially with men, they're not going to bring it up. And we have to find a way to bring it up in a way that's, of course, it's about their appearance, but it can also be about function too. So I think relating appearance to function can be very helpful.
That makes very good advice for taking this conversation into the exam room. I want to switch gears a little bit. We're talking about inflammation along the eyelid, and one of the really common buzz topics that's coming up in aesthetics right now is about lash growth serums. I want to get your opinion. How do you talk about lash growth serums with your patient, and any kind of general recommendations?
Yeah, so this is definitely a hot topic right now, and I think there are people on extreme polar ends of anti-lash serum and then people who are just very pro-lash serum, and you're going to find me kind of in the middle, because and I will admit I use a lash serum that I've been using for 6 months. I use it every night. My lashes are fantastic. I really like the results for myself. I personally have no problems on my own eyes with a lash serum, but there are people who are going to have problems, and I think it's our job as eye care professionals to be reasonable with people and to guide them properly. So you are going to have people who are going to go to very great lengths to have long eyelashes. You know, I see patients getting, you know, just putting on false lashes daily. I see people getting lash extensions. I see people getting eyelash perms. Daryl, did you know that was a thing? You get your eyelashes permed.
Nowadays, nothing surprises me, but that sounds crazy as I don't know what.
But the thing is, some of these products are going to irritate some people's eyes. There are going to be a lot of patients that can use these products successfully without any concerns. And so I don't think there's any product that's bad for everyone, and I don't think there's any product that's good for everyone. I think we have to take this as a very, just like we do everything else with mascara and eye creams. There are eye creams that bother some people's eyes. There are mascaras that bother some people's eyes and not others. I think what's important, and I know the big hot topic, is that there are some lash serums out there that have synthetic prostaglandins in them. And I think that's a conversation that needs to be had across the eye care community. One of the biggest things that's talked about right now is a prostaglandin analog called isopropyl clostridate. And this is in a handful of over-the-counter lash serum. And there are, yes, it is a synthetic prostaglandin. And prostaglandins in general, we know, have the side effects of, you know, darkening the eye and the skin around the eye. It can be irritating the ocular surface. But I think what's important to realize with any lash serum, or honestly, let's just talk about straight up Latisse. So Latisse is just 100% prostaglandin that you apply to your eyelid rather than in your eye for glaucoma. All the studies that we have right now talking about the side effects of prostaglandins are from studies for people using this drop in their eye nightly for glaucoma. So we don't, I mean, and even Allergan will tell you, they did not, the reason that they have all the side effect profiles listed on Latisse are the same ones that they have on, you know, their glaucoma medicines, is because they didn't go back and seek FDA approval to get those side effects taken off, because that's just a process. So we actually don't have, and this is something we need, we do not have studies documenting the actual risk or harm from putting these products with prostaglandins just on the eyelid. And, you know, not just Latisse, but the other products containing isopropyl clostridate, that is a very small percentage of a synthetic prostaglandin mixed with other ingredients that can be potentially nourishing to the eyelashes. So, you know, I do think we need more studies.
Dr. Redfern, I absolutely agree. One thing that I also touch on with my patients, and I'd like to know your perspective on it, is the wind tunnel that is formed by eyelashes that are too long. What kind of conversation, what kind of dialogue are you having with your patients when you're discussing eyelash length?
Yes, and I think, yes, and I love this topic. I've actually been following a paper that was written for a little more than 4 years now. I read that paper. Yes, so when your eyelashes are at the optimal length, which is approximately 1/3, so if your eyelashes are 1/3 of the width of your eye, okay, that perfectly deflects debris and air from the ocular surface. And we know that going too long can actually attract wind and debris to the eyelids, but we also know that going too short if you have too short of eyelids, they don't serve as a protection. So although, yes, I do agree that having too long of eyelashes can absolutely increase dryness. From my personal experience, the only time I see people that truly have lashes that are longer than a third of the width of the eye, and they're false lashes or lash extension, I have yet to see, and I'm sure I'm wrong because I've only seen what I've seen, but the people that I know who are using lash serums, I feel like a lot of the times the lashes actually get to a pretty normal, quote unquote, normal length, and sometimes it can be helpful. So I'm in no way promoting a lash serum as a treatment for dry eye. However, me personally, my lashes were maybe, I had no eyelashes before I started using my lash serum, and maybe they were an eighth of the width of my eye. And I was having some end of day discomfort with my contact. So now, of course, because of the optometrist in me, I've actually taken out one of my longer looking eyelashes and kind of held it up to the horizontal, you know, width of my eye. And it just happens to be about a third. Not perfect, but so I found that getting my lashes longer than what they were has actually helped me tremendously. And so again, I know that that may be kind of a stretch, but too long is bad and too short is also bad.
It's one of those things where I feel like when we're talking about this stuff, like you said, everybody's going to have a different experience with it. And even that, looking at those prostaglandin analog Latisse studies, it was only 4% of the patient users that were having these pro-inflammatory side effects. At the same time, they weren't doing a meibomian gland or dry eye assessment when that was one of the things they were looking for during that study. It was more the darkening of the lids and lid inflammation and periorbital fat dissolution. So in my personal practice, this is how I'm approaching it, and everybody is free to do it their different way. If I have a patient who tells me their own lash growth errors or asks me about them, I tell them to look for side effects that is causing inflammation for them. If their eyes are burning or stinging or puffy or red, it's probably an indication that this product is not right for you. Okay. And it seems to be causing inflammation, obviously, on the surface of the eye. The other thing that I'm doing, and I'm lucky because I do have lipid scans within my practice, so I can actually image my meibomian glands. I'm taking before images whenever I have that chance of catching them before they start using them. And then I'm recommending, let's see you back in 6 months and take another image. If we're seeing signs of gland atrophy and dropout, then that's going to be an indication that maybe something's going wrong with lash growth for their personal body chemistry. So I'm trying to do it more that way instead of saying just a frank, no, you shouldn't be taking that. That could be bad for you. And get a little bit more data and information. I don't have anybody yet that's returned for 6 months, so I have absolutely no findings to report. But I'm just curious to see if we actually see something and the glands actually do get impacted. And I'm sure there's someone out there with a lot bigger practice volume than me that's going to have a report on this, hopefully in the near future.
Yes, and you know, this is something that I've been thinking about this so much. I feel like this is one of those things that's so hard to study. And I've wanted to do it on myself. You know, wanted to go to a colleague and say, hey, image my glands, see what's going on. I'm using the serum. But you know what's so hard is that we still don't know how, you know, I wear toric soft lenses. I've worn hybrid lenses for years. I've worn all kinds of things. I don't know how that's impacted my meibomian glands. It's very hard to study. And I will say one other thing. There are certain people that have come in and asked, can I use this lash serum? That I've told absolutely no. So I had this one patient, for example, she had been treated for years for chronic bilateral uveitis. And of course that's systemic. There's other things going on, but her eyes were finally clear. And she brings in a lash serum and says, can I use this? And I said, nope, absolutely not. I don't know that that will cause enough inflammation to flare up your uveitis, but we are not taking a chance. And so I think we really just have to use common sense. We have to use the knowledge that we all have as eye care providers and use common sense. I mean, if you have a healthy young 20, 30 something year old girl who wants to use a product and it's not bothering her at all, go for it. Watch them. And people may disagree with this too, but I actually think getting your natural lashes to look better with a lash serum is overall probably less irritating than going getting extensions and putting false lashes on with glue every day. So again, I feel like we just have to use our own common sense and use the education that we've all received wisely and apply it to each individual patient.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's why any patient that comes in that inquires about anything related to this topic, I always bring them back for a dry eye workup, run the tear lab, run some dyes on the eye, and just see how the overall tear film is. And if it's healthy, we proceed. If it's not healthy, we fix that. And then at the end of treatment, we consider maybe even using any of this stuff if it's a good decision or not. But I'll always, always, always bring it back for a dry eye treatment. And then they understand it. I mean, I tell them the test that I'm doing. I explain why I'm doing the test. And it also just brings more money to the office as well with a medical office visit.
Daryl, you're always so practical. Of course, the other great thing about aesthetics is that it is a potential practice builder. And we are seeing this a lot on the forums online, people talking about maybe retailing aesthetics products within their own practice. So Dr. Redford, do you have any advice on doctors who might be interested in doing that?
Yes, and my advice is do it. Because if you're not recommending, here's the thing, patients are going to ask. So I knew this one OD also who, before he became educated about aesthetics, his patients would ask him all the time, what should I use for my skin? And he told me one time, he said, I have no idea, but my wife uses Clinique, so it must be good. So I send them all to Clinique counter. But think about how many people he sent away when he could have been offering something in his office. So that's the thing. People are going to get skincare, eye creams, lash serums, mascaras, somewhere. They are using it. Why not have them buy it from you? Because they trust you. They know that you have their best interest at heart. They know if they have an issue for one of those products, you can help them with it. If they go buy skincare from a store and they have a reaction, those people in that store cannot help them. We're just losing out on so much, not only profit, but trust with our patients if we don't offer what they need. And if, you know, even to the males out there, even if you're not comfortable with skincare, that's okay. We can all learn. But your patient, after they know that their eyes are healthy and that you've helped them see as good as they possibly can, they know that you can help them with their skin issues as well. Not only are you going to really increase your patient loyalty, but that is wonderful for your bottom line. Because here's the deal. We don't have to wait for insurance reimbursement for these products. These are products that patients are going to continue to buy. Once you have them on a skincare regimen, an eye cream that they like, a lash serum that they like and works for them, they're going to keep using it. People often ask me, so if I get my skin how I like it, or if I get my lashes how I like them, or if I get my eyes, you know, to where I like how they look, do I need to keep up with this? And because they just want it to be done and not have to do it anymore. And I use the analogy of a gym. If you go to the gym for a year and you get your body how you like it, and then you just sit on the couch for another year, well, you're not going to maintain that. So these are consumable products that your patients are going to continually need to get from you. Glasses may last a year or two, but generally skincare regimens last a month or two or three. So they're going to be coming back to your office more often. You know, that's a great time too. They can be coming to your office, and while they're getting their refill of their skincare or their lash product, they can look at your new sunglasses. I mean, there's just so many benefits. I don't know why anyone wouldn't offer them.
And Dr. Redfern, something else to consider too is just the marketing aspect. I mean, if you take a young lady and you make her lashes longer and look more beautiful, she's just going to tell all her friends, and you're just going to get a surplus of patients coming in just off of that experience. And it just builds the practice even more. So I'm all in. Yeah. I love it.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the thing too. You know, I had this girl that I referenced earlier who asked me about what can I use for under my eyes. And, you know, I called her to check on her after she started using an eye cream that I recommended. And she said, oh my goodness, I can't wait. My sister's coming in to get some too. It's great. And so, yes, everything that we do has the potential to create a word of mouth referral. And we all know word of mouth is the best way to grow any business.
What I like about this is, you know, you can get in as much as you want. Me personally, I probably am not at the place yet where I feel really comfortable retailing any sort of lash serum or anything in the office, just because I am still figuring out how much are these side effects something that I need to be actively concerned about on my patients. But if, you know, everybody's different, so you can do all in on this one thing, or like what I've been looking at more doing is you looking at eyelid cleansers myself. And so I've like gone through all these different cleansers of what I want to recommend, what I don't. And that's been a really good source. If I can offer something that I feel like is really all natural, anti-inflammatory, doesn't have any preservatives or cleaning products that could be eye irritants. So you can be as little into it or as all into it as you want to be. And it's still giving your patients such a value to have a real recommendation for their skin chemistry in the office.
Absolutely. And I think anything you can recommend above and beyond glasses and contacts is going to show your patients that you really care about them as a whole. And I think that's so important.
We were talking about, you know, there's all these different options out there and saying a firm no to people to extreme cases where I feel like that is definitely warranted. Like you mentioned about uveitis, and for me, like a severe dry eye patient already, I'd be like, okay, nothing. We do not need to add anything to the surface here that could exacerbate this. But are there any skincare or enhancement procedures that you have people coming in and asking about that you just universally say, no, I do not recommend?
There is one thing definitely in particular, and that's tattooing of eyelids, of the eyelids for permanent eyeliner.
I was thinking about getting that done next week myself.
That'll look great on you, Daryl.
You know, of course, the obvious reason for that is, goodness gracious, that tattoo needle, that ink is going right where your meibomian glands are, and that's just a great way to kill them all. And so the unfortunate part is, though, I've never actually had anybody ask me my opinion before they get it done. I always see it after it's done. And I would say universally that is the one thing right off the top of my head that I would never, ever condone having done, because that damage is permanent and lasting.
So true. It's not reversible. The one other thing that I've been hearing, and it's real popular in my area, you mentioned it earlier, these lash perms. Yeah. I do not think I could ever say like, oh, it'd probably be say like chemical sort of situation. If anything gets along the eye, it is very pro-inflammatory. I know it's temporary and the surface can heal, but it's just such a harsh procedure. I think there's so many better ways to get nicer looking lashes.
And I completely agree with that. So I can't say that I actually would recommend that, but there's always the other side. So I did have one patient who was very irritated by almost all mascaras and almost anything she would use to take off her mascara. And so she went and got one of these just on her own. I didn't tell her to go get one. And she came back and said, oh my goodness, now that I'm not having to use my mascara and take it off every night, my eyes feel better. And so I agree with you so very completely that no, that just seems very like a very unnatural thing to recommend. And I'm not saying I recommend it, but goodness gracious, for some people, it's a better alternative. People will go to great lengths. And in some cases, it may be the lesser of two evils. It's hard. It's a hard thing.
Such a good point. As with all things in optometry, we have to weigh the individual sitting in front of us. And unfortunately, we don't have the ease of saying, there's just one solution for every single person. That's why our jobs are so difficult and so demanding, but also so inspiring, because there's no cookie cutter approach that solves every person's problem.
Absolutely.
Dr. Redford, how can our listeners get in touch with you if they have aesthetic questions or want to get some more insight and advice from you?
You can definitely email me if you'd like. My email is jredfernod@gmail.com, or I do a lot of my communicating via Facebook. You can find me on Facebook Messenger. I'm just Jenny Redfern on Facebook. That would be the easiest ways to do that.
Thank you so much for your time today. I think we all learned a lot, and I can't wait to see where this conversation goes next, because there's so much more in the realm of aesthetics for us to dig into.
Absolutely. Thank you guys both so very much.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast, and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.